Every time you throw a punch, girl, you break your own jaw. Arlene sighed, waited for the tears to come, but they didn't. They just came up missing somehow. She breathed again and decided she felt a lot clearer.
Nah, I won't, Bonnie. You know that. If I was going to do that, I wouldn't have called you.
I know. You just need to talk.
I feel a little better now.
Call again if you want.
Maybe tomorrow. Tonight I think I'll hike over to Cheryl's and bend Ricky's ear. Give him a taste of what I'm mad about.
If he'll help you, go ahead. You know damn well it ain't going to help him.
Just as she was leaving the house, she realized she hadn't packed up Ricky's shotgun. She'd begun to feel a little quieter and more centered, so she took it along. It was a longer walk than she remembered. It didn't feel right, her having to go on foot, her having to be the one with two jobs, walking. But she had to follow this thought through. Cheryl answered the door in her bathrobe, then almost closed it again. Arlene could see that little reflex.
"Too late to change your mind now,"
Cheryl said.
"Oh, I didn't. Just that Ricky's got something of mine, I got something of his. I just want to trade up. Then we'll be all settled and done."
A familiar voice, faint, calling out from the bedroom.
"What is it, hon?"
"Never mind," Arlene said, pushing past. "I'll tell him who it is."
She stepped into the bedroom with Cheryl dogging close behind and found him in bed, the sheets pulled up to his waist. It was a hot night, and no cooler in Cheryl's bedroom.
"Arlene, what the hell? You folks turn in early, huh? Well, I won't stay and chat. Where's the keys to the GTO?"
"Why? Why do you ask? I don't like nobody driving my car. You know that."
"Well, that don't matter now, Ricky, because it's not your car. You're giving it to me."
"Hell, I am. I built that car from the ground up. It's my baby." "No goddamn way, Arlene. Where the hell do you get off?"
Cheryl gave Arlene's shoulder a little pull and said,
"Get the hell out of here, or I'm calling the police."
Arlene opened the shotgun case. She was able to do it quickly because she'd left the lock at home. It was her lock, after all. She turned around, not so much to point the gun at Cheryl, but of course it pointed where Arlene did.
"Go on and do that then, Cheryl. They're pretty damn slow, and this won't take long."
She turned back to Ricky, who'd managed to plaster himself to the headboard.
"Here's where I get off, Ricky. You sweet-talked me into co-signing that truck. You swore in your honor you'd never let me down. Then you totaled it, left me to work two jobs to pay it, and got something else real nice. Now you got two choices. Pay me every cent I'm out for that truck, or give me the damn GTO.
He held up his hands in calm, slow gestures, as if to hypnotize the violence out of her. But really, she wasn't feeling violent, just set on clearing things up.
"Put the gun down, baby. We can talk. I think we'll have a better talk this way. You know, Ricky, I used to feel so bad for you because you told me them stories about all the women in your life tried to kill you. How your first wife held a loaded gun in your face and Cheryl threw that blanket over you and beat you with a skillet. And that one in between took that knife to you. I thought to myself, poor Ricky, getting mixed up with all these crazy women. But you know, I really understand now. Get a piece of paper. You can write me out a bill of sale."
He scrambled for a little message pad in the drawer of the bedside table. Cheryl threw him a pen. Arlene hadn't heard her call the police, and didn't much care if she had. This was just a nice, calm business transaction.
"So I'm selling you my GTO."
"Damn straight."
"Make it up for how much?"
$1, and other valuable considerations. Don't try putting the wrong license number. I'm not too dumb to check.
What are the other considerations I get?
I think it would be very considerate of me not to shoot you. Don't you think so?
He put his head down and concentrated on a flurry of scribbling, then handed the slip over, reaching out carefully, ready to jump back. She read his scribbling.
"You forgot to sign it."
"Oh, yeah."
He signed it and handed it back.
"Where are the keys?"
He balked a moment, sulked almost like a little boy. Then he said,
"Better get her the keys, Cheryl."
Arlene took them on her way out the door.
"Thanks. Here's Ricky's shotgun. Now we're all even. Oh, wait. I forgot."
She dug a dollar out of her pocket and threw it on the living room floor. She left the gun in Cheryl's arms and walked to her new car. She liked it. It was kind of slick. Nice new race car paint job, though maybe orange was not ideal. Pretty under the hood. She'd have to replace those old glass-pack mufflers, of course, so the whole goddamn world didn't have to hear her coming. At her back, she heard Ricky say,
"Damn, I really love that car."
She sat in the driver's seat and started it up. It rumbled underneath her while she adjusted the seat to fit her legs. Before she could shift it into drive, Ricky arrived at the window with the shotgun and stood spraddle-legged and angry, aiming through the window at her head.
"Get out right now, Arlene. I mean it. Give me that bill of sale back and nobody gets hurt."
She rolled the window halfway down.
"Oh, I forgot to tell you. I don't keep it loaded. And I didn't bring any shells. I bought those, remember?"
In the red glow of her taillight, she enjoyed the look on his face for an instant. Then he faded into the night, the dark, the past. She stopped at the auto parts store on the Camino, which was open until 9, and bought one of those club things for the steering wheel. Then she took it out for a ride, just for the joy of riding. It had a lot of power. It would get her around. She was beginning to feel a little better. She had no special place to drive, so she drove by Reuben's house. A light burned in the bedroom, and his car was parked out front. She circled the block and drove by again. On the third trip, she stopped and cut the engine and just sat a while, looking, thinking about a time when she was welcomed there and could have knocked and gone right in, thinking about how the cat used to rub under her chin to wake her up, and how they would have been married by now and could have pooled their financial resources to get her a new car. He would have helped. She knew he would. That was just the kind of man he was. Something big and heavy sat in her chest. It felt harder and harder to breathe around it. After a while, she drove home. She put the club thing on the steering wheel and locked it up for the night. He might come back for it, but she'd report it stolen if he did. She had a bill of sale, all nice and legal. She'd tell the cop, "I demanded my money for the truck, but he couldn't pay it, so I said I'd take the GTO. He signed it over to me. He didn't have to, you know. Nobody held a gun to his head." Then she remembered that Ricky had 2 outstanding warrants in this state and felt much better about her chances of finding the car in her driveway in the morning. She tried calling Reuben, but he didn't answer the phone. It wasn't very late. How did he even know it was her? She tried to lie down and sleep, but nothing happened. Other than the thoughts that rolled around in her head, like all the things she'd said to Reuben on the phone last night, and whether he'd even been listening or not. She got up and dressed again and checked the car, which was still there. She drove over to Reuben's again and sat outside for an hour. When she saw the lights go out, she knew it must be time to move, one way or another. Go in or go home. No point to just sit there all night. Her heart pounding in her ears, she walked around to his back door and knocked. The bedroom light came on again. The back door opened, and Reuben stood in the doorway in his bathrobe. He didn't look angry. Big and imposing, that he looked. And yet at the same time vulnerable somehow. Like he couldn't really make her go away, even if she were to physically drive home.
"I thought you were just going to sit out there all night," he said.
"You knew I was out there?"
"Of course I did."
"How'd you know that?"
"Your muffler made me look out the window. Or lack of muffler. Where'd you get that car?"
"It's kind of a long story."
"You left Trevor home alone?"
She smelled a hint of judgment, as if he'd accused her of losing whatever manners and sense he'd helped her to find.
"He's spending the night at a friend's."
"Oh."
He slid his hands into the pockets of his robe, and they stood a moment, both looking down at the stoop.
"Why the back door?"
he said after a time. But that was a question she couldn't quite answer. If called upon to guess, she might say it had something to do with shame, but she wasn't anxious to learn exactly what. So she changed the subject as best she could.
"I love you, Reuben."
She allowed the words to echo between them until their sting wore off. She hoped he would say something, maybe even something nice, but she could only wait just so long.
"I guess that's all I came by to say. I know it doesn't really change what happened, but I wanted you to know. I don't guess I ever said that before, even though it was true enough. Anyway, I just had to say it now."
His hands came out of his pockets to hang at his sides, and his chin rose slightly. He said,
"I noticed you didn't feel compelled to say that until it was over with him."
His hand came up to the edge of the door, leading her to believe she'd better talk fast before it slammed shut.
"That's not why, though, Reuben. I know it looks that way, but it's not. You know why? It's because of that time you drove Trevor home, and you went by the driveway and slowed down, almost stopped. Until then, I thought you just flat out wouldn't talk to me. After that, I knew part of you wanted to talk to me and part of you didn't."
She winced slightly, waiting for the door to slam. But his hand found its way down to his side again.
"I know you don't forgive me, Reuben. I don't expect you to, but some little part of you must miss me, right? God knows I miss you."
She reached for his dangling right hand, and he allowed it to be held. He looked into her face for a minute, even though it seemed to hurt him. The light wasn't good, coming mostly from behind him, and she wasn't sure of her ability to read his face. She smiled, hoping he could see, hoping she was not about to cry. Holding her hand firmly, he stepped back and pulled her inside. In the morning, the sun came in strong across the head of his bed, just the way she remembered. She opened her eyes to see him awake and watching her. When she smiled, he rolled away.
"Hey, you okay?"
He didn't answer.
"Talk to me, Reuben."
"This is probably a mistake."
"Yeah, well, that's just your opinion."
He rose and began to dress. His scars seemed sadder somehow in bright daylight, and in a moment when he insisted upon distance between them. He might have known this, because he dressed quickly.
"Fine," he said. "You caught me in the middle of the night. I let you in. Things got carried away. Now I guess you think everything that happened is water under the bridge. Well, it isn't."
He perched on the edge of the bed, faced away as if this was the only thing he still remembered how to do. She moved over to his side of the bed, sat up, draped herself across his back, and tried to hold him. His body felt stiff and resistant.
"Don't, okay? Just go home now, Arlene."
She could hear in his voice that he was crying, and it startled her. He never had done that before, so far as she knew. It was a weakness she attributed only to herself. And she knew he would want no witness to the moment. So she did as she had been asked. Chapter 26. Chris. Until Sally called, he didn't realize, consciously, how much he had missed her. He hadn't let himself realize. He had allowed it to hover, little bats at the edges of his day's work, shadows in his periphery. But he had ways to keep things at a proper distance. Obsession with work, obsessive exercise, too much sleep, too little sleep, drinking himself to sleep. But then she called, and there it was, all that feeling. And he knew in some part it had been there all along. She asked how he'd been, and he said fine, which was a lie. She asked how the story was going, and he said it was going. It was gone, dead-ended, a cold trail. Which was true. Then nobody said anything for a painful few seconds, and he asked her out to dinner. She said she'd had dinner out every night this week, but if he'd come over to her new apartment, she'd cook. He said he loved her, which was true, but it caused her to fumble a bit and make it clear she would still hold on to the right to reserve judgment. It was after dinner when the phone rang. He was sitting close to her on the couch, thinking how familiar it was, the smell of her. Maybe partly perfume, partly just her skin. Or maybe her skin smelled like perfume. He wasn't sure. He was thinking a drink would be nice, but not saying that. Then the phone rang, and he prayed it would not be for him. She picked it up, and her face went dark. She covered the mouthpiece with her hand.
"You gave out this number?"
He shook his head.
"Call forward."
Whatever moment they had been close to achieving, it disappeared from his horizon. He knew that. It cracked in the air between them, and he felt it.
"As a young lady, for you, it's not what you're thinking."
She handed him the phone and left the room. He sat breathing, holding the receiver for a moment. He could hear her in the kitchen, moving dishes in the sink, a bit harder and louder than necessary. He always ended up being himself in front of her, with his real life all too visible. And then it all fell down. "Hello?"
"Chris Chandler?"
"Yeah, who's this?" He tried not to sound irritated, but it might not have worked.
"Terry from the grocery store. You know, from Atascadero. Am I catching you at a bad time?"
No, it's fine, Terry. What's up?"
"Well, you said to call you if I thought of anything. Only this probably isn't much. It's probably nothing. But I did think of something. That last time I saw her, I remember what she was in such a good mood about. I remember I said her garden looked really nice, and her face just kind of lit up. And she said, 'Oh, isn't it wonderful,' or something like that. She said, 'The neighbor boy did all that.' She told me his name, but I forget it now."
Chris waited in silence a moment, hoping for, expecting something more. Her garden had been important to her. That much he already knew.
"Well, I said it was probably nothing."
"No, I'm glad you called, Terry, really. If you think of anything else..."
"Well, that's it, I guess. For now, just that she was all happy about the garden."
"I appreciate you calling, Terry. I really do."
"Well, I don't want to run up my phone bill. Bye."
He hung up the phone, blinking slowly, and saw her standing in the kitchen doorway. "Oh, God, Sally, it's not what you're thinking. I'm not seeing anyone. It was just one of those people I interviewed about that story." She didn't move out of the doorway. He wondered if she believed him. If she ever did. If she ever had. If she really should.
"I'm trying to decide if that's better or worse," she said.
But then she smiled and came back and sat close. He picked up the phone and left it off the hook. It was just as he was moving onto the bed. That's when it began to hit him. Shirt off, pants unzipped, following her naked body as if tethered to it. Not trying to think about anything else, not realizing there could be anything else to think about. It came through the back of his mind, in the unwelcome voice of Richard Greenberg, or Green, or whatever the hell his name was, 3 sentences, echoing when least wanted.
"Says she didn't pay him. He did it for free." "Yeah, right. Kids love to do that."
He pushed the words away again. She pulled them down, her mouth on his neck, hands exploring his bare back. So familiar. So sorely missed.
"What's wrong?"
she said.
"Nothing. Nothing's wrong. Why?" "You seem distant."
"No. I'm right here. God, I missed you." He kissed her. Richard was right. She paid a kid to do her garden. She must have, which had no bearing on this situation whatever. Useless. So she was happy because her garden had just been done. It meant nothing. One of his legs sliding between hers. How had he lived without this so long? Said she didn't pay him. He did it for free. Big favor for a kid. For anybody. What kind of kid would do that for free?
"You are not right here, Chris."
"Huh? I'm not?" He rolled over onto his back and knew. Something religious in the revelation, because he'd asked Mrs. Greenberg for a sign. "Let me see something." And all the while, he'd been looking right at it.
What kind of kid would do that for free?
Same kind of kid would keep doing it for free long after the lady was dead.
He'd been looking at the next link back, and he'd driven away.
He shouldn't have asked the kid if he knew about her will. What a stupid way to go at it. Why would the kid know about her will? Why should he? Nobody knows how someone else is going to pay it forward. He should have asked the paperboy if he knew anything about the movement.
"The paperboy,"
he said out loud. Sally got up and began to dress. "Go home now, Chris."
"I'm sorry. That makes 2 of us.
He sat on Mrs. Greenberg's front porch. The weather hadn't changed. Or if it had, it had changed back to hot in his honor. The neighbor lady across the street glanced out her kitchen window now and then, as though she'd do well to keep an eye on him. "Imagine how crazy she'd think I am," he thought, "if she knew I'd come 3,000 miles to sit here. Twice." A paperboy came by, on foot, walking the route with a cloth bag over his shoulder. A red-haired boy with freckles. He lobbed a paper at the house next door.
"Hey, kid!"
The kid froze, looked panicked, didn't answer.
"I don't bite.
I'm not supposed to talk to strangers.
I just want to know what happened to the other kid."
"What other kid?"
"The paperboy who was here last month."
"He won the prize."
"What prize?"
"Best paperboy of the year."
"So, where is he?"
"He won the week off with pay."
Oh, crap. Chris thought of the nearly maxed MasterCard in his shirt pocket. It wouldn't keep him here another week. The red-haired boy was trying to hurry past.
What's his name, do you know?"
"Trevor."
"Trevor what?"
"I forget."
Level with Mrs. Greenberg's walkway, the boy broke into a run and disappeared down the street. Chris began walking in the opposite direction. Passing the next-door neighbor's lawn, he briefly picked up their paper. The Atascadero News Press. He memorized the street number of their office on the main drag, El Camino Real. A wave of heat hit him as he opened the rental car door. By the time he found the office, it was closed for the day. He slept fitfully after much trying and woke after 8 to the day's heat already gearing up to punish him. He could feel it gather strength. He couldn't remember when he'd last eaten. He had breakfast at Denny's, found the newspaper office again, sold them a song and dance about a national award for enterprising young people. They gave him a name and address without question. He got lost twice trying to find it, finally had to stop for gas and a map. When he knocked on the door, it was after 9. It wasn't until the sound of his knock faded that Chris felt awake enough to realize that the kid would not be home. Kids go to school on weekdays. A small, pretty, dark-haired woman flew out the door. "I'm 20 minutes late for work. Whatever the hell you're selling, I ain't buying it." She pushed past him into the driveway and stood beside an orange GTO from the 60s, fumbled in her purse for keys, he assumed. The car was parked behind a late-model truck, stripped and damaged as though it had been through a meteor shower.
"Shit," the woman said. "Left my keys in the house."
"What happened to that truck?"
"Looks like somebody took a lead pipe to it." The woman turned the knob on her front door, then ran into it, as though amazed that it didn't open.
"Shit! I locked myself out!"
She turned to consider him, as if for the first time.
"Who the hell are you, and why aren't you going away?"
"My name is Chris Chandler. I'm a reporter. I'm looking for Trevor McKinney."
"He's at school. Where the hell you think he'd be? And I'm late for work and locked out, and standing here talking to you ain't putting me in no better mood."
"Did you leave any windows open?"
"Just that high one."
He laced his fingers and offered his hands like a stirrup, poised under what he assumed to be the bathroom window. She stepped up onto his hands, surprisingly light. She reached up to the window, put her fingers under the screen, and pulled hard, bending the frame. The screen shot across the driveway, mangled, he presumed, beyond repair. It landed beside the truck, looking only lightly used in comparison. She leaned the top half of her body through the window, and he hoisted her up higher. She disappeared. A moment later, she came barreling out the front door again.
"So, where's Trevor's school?"
"I'm late for work."
"You'd have been a lot later if I wasn't here."
"I wouldn't have locked myself out if you hadn't distracted me at the last minute."
"Where's that school again?"
"What the hell do you want with my son?"
"Just want to ask him a couple of questions about a Mrs. Greenberg."
"I don't know no Mrs. Greenberg."
"He does."
"Well, for all I know, you could be a kidnapper or a pervert. I gotta go."
She dropped into the low bucket seat, struggled briefly with a club on the steering wheel, fired, and revved the engine. The old glass-pack mufflers roared. She drove off without so much as a wave goodbye, cutting a little close to his legs on the way out of the driveway. As it turned out, there was only one junior high school in town anyway. Chris stopped at the office, where he was given a visitor's pass and instructions to room 203, where Trevor McKinney was apparently scheduled to arrive for social studies class. When he stepped into the classroom, only the teacher was present. Chris stared at the teacher's face for a protracted moment, then glanced away. He felt he needed to look more closely, but didn't dare. "Chris Chandler," he said, and stepped forward to shake the teacher's hand, focusing awkwardly on his tie.
"I'm looking for Trevor McKinney. I was told he'd be here next period."
He flashed his visitor's pass.
"Yes. Take a seat, Mr. Chandler."
The teacher seemed curious, but asked no questions. Chris didn't want to sit at a small desk, but, in a kind of regression, felt compelled to do as he'd been told. The room looked small to him. He wondered if his own junior high had been bigger or if it was all a matter of perspective. He glanced at the teacher's face again, and the man looked up as if he could tell. Chris turned his eyes to the blackboard as though he'd planned to all along. The board was blank, freshly erased, except for a sentence in neat block lettering. Think of an idea for world change and put it into action. Is that an assignment?
Yes.
Interesting assignment.
It can be.
Any of the students changed the world yet?
Not yet. Some of them have had good ideas. Trevor had a particularly good one.
Three students walked in and slapped books down on desktops. Chris recognized the paper boy immediately. The boy looked back at him. Remember me? Chris said.
I think so.
From Mrs. Greenberg's house?
Oh, yeah.
The boy walked over and stood by his desk.
I think I asked you the wrong question, Chris said.
So now what I'm going to ask is this. Did somebody do a big favor for you, and is that why you take care of Mrs. Greenberg's garden for free?
No. Nobody did a big favor for me.
You don't know anything about the movement? The boy's face looked blank.
The what?
Chris felt something sink in his gut. Another expensive trip to nowhere. Another dead end. What good would it have done, anyway? So the boy might have taken him one link back. Then it all falls down again. His girlfriend was right. It was all obsession with him. No thought or sense. And all too often it added up to nothing. He stood to leave.
Well, bye,
Trevor said. Chris shifted his weight from one foot to the other and back again.
Your teacher told me you had an interesting idea for that assignment.
He pointed to the blackboard. The room was filling up with children now, a claustrophobic feeling.
Yeah, I invented this thing called paying it forward. It was for last year's class. I got the best grade, but you know what? It was a total bust.
That tingle hit behind Chris's ears, a hot feeling, slightly dizzy. He smiled.
Maybe it didn't work out as bad as you thought, he said.
From the Diary of Trevor.
There are absolutely no words for how cool this is. First off, everybody's telling my mom what a great mom she is. And everybody's telling Reuben what a great teacher he is. And then they're saying, I'm a great kid. And I say, nah, not really. I mean, anybody could have thought of this. It's so simple. Sometimes I think, how could it work? That's so amazing. And other times I think, how could it not work? It's so simple. The part about believing people might really do it? I bet that's the part nobody could get right before now. But you know what? If they want to tell me I'm brilliant and special, let them. It makes Mom and Reuben happy.
Chapter 27 Arlene.
You taping this, Mom?
Arlene was not only taping, but counting the number of times he asked.
Yes, Trevor, like I told you the last 6 times.
But there was no anger or genuine impatience in her words. She understood.
I think we need more chips, Mom.
Arlene sighed. Normally, she'd have told him to get up and get more chips himself. His hands weren't broken. But his grandma was here, having driven all the way from Redlands to share this moment. And Joe and Loretta and Bonnie and Ricky's sister Evelyn, the boy's aunt, were here. And Reuben was a maybe, though he hadn't shown yet. And it was an irreplaceable special moment for the boy, Trevor's very own moment. So Arlene supposed she could understand how he didn't want to miss even a minute of the program, even though it was going on tape. Even though Chris had promised him a professionally taped version of the segment. Even though the segment hadn't begun yet and everybody was staring in endless nervous fascination at a story about welfare reform that would have bored them to tears on any other night. She brought a fresh bag of chips out from the kitchen, and the show went to commercial. Arlene pushed the long, ribbony hanging strings of a few helium balloons out of her way to wade through bodies to the VCR.
Don't turn it off!
Trevor shouted, and everyone jumped.
You want the commercials? Maybe they'll come back and say something about the next story. Okay, fine. I ain't touching it.
She raised her hands in an exaggerated surrender. She went back to the kitchen for another beer for her mama and a 7-Up for Loretta. She pulled back the kitchen curtain, staring down the empty street as if she might see him drive up. Maybe he was just running a little late, she thought, even though he'd never been late to anything in his life, so far as Arlene knew. Then she heard it from the living room, a narrator talking about Sidney G. and the story they'd done before, how a bit more information had come to light, how pleased they thought the viewers would be to see the real thinker behind this wave of kindness that threatened to take over the country with sudden goodwill. And then they said Trevor's name. It made her stomach tingle. Trevor's name on national TV. My son, she thought. And her knees felt a little too wobbly to move back into the living room. Just for a moment she wondered if it was really fair to call him her son, even though he was, because it felt like taking credit for his sudden fame. Really, she did not feel the least bit accountable. By all rights, any son of hers should have been an average kid, and she supposed in most ways Trevor was, which is what made all this so odd and amazing.
Mom, get in here, quick! It's on!
She wobbled into the living room with little help from those knees. On the small screen, Trevor was riding his bike down Mrs. Greenberg Street, throwing newspapers onto the lawns. Trevor, her boy, the same one who sat on the couch in twitching silence, watching. Arlene tried to remember if she had ever known anyone who had been on television, but no one came to mind. Oh, that old bike looked so crappy. She'd have to get him a new one. Why hadn't she already? My God, what would people think? She leaned both hands on the back of the couch, and her mama reached back to put a hand on Arlene's, gave it a squeeze, and then left it there. It was such a strange moment, she almost forgot to watch the show. But it was on tape anyway, and she'd probably have to watch it 4 or 5 times before it all sank in properly. Her mama's hand on hers. For once in Arlene's whole goddamn life, she must have done something worthy. Now Trevor was standing in the yard beside Mrs. Greenberg's house, showing where he keeps the dry cat food that he buys with his own money, because he knows Mrs. Greenberg wouldn't want any of those strays to miss a meal in her absence. And the power lawnmower he uses to keep her grass neat, even though it isn't really hers anymore. And the plastic gas can he has to tie to the handlebars of his bike when the mower runs out of gas. And most of this was unfamiliar to her. She was learning, along with much of the country, what her son did while out of the house. He had a life, and it hadn't struck her before, at least not in such an obvious way, that he existed on his own, apart from her. Now the inside of a classroom. Her gut constricted at the image of Reuben in front of his blackboard, in front of that sentence, the one that started it all. She reached across the couch and gave Trevor a little nudge on the shoulder.
Did he say he'd come? Huh? Reuben. He said he'd try.
Suddenly Arlene felt the need to drive by his house to see if he was sitting home, watching in bed alone, to avoid her company. But it didn't seem right to duck out of the festivities. Not on Trevor's big night. In a few minutes, when the segment ended, she had to be here to break out the chilled champagne for the grown-ups. Well, not for her or Loretta or Bonnie, but for the other grown-ups. And the sparkling apple juice for Trevor. Only, if he asked, maybe he could have just a couple of sips of champagne, in honor of his big night. Maybe Reuben would arrive in time for the post-program celebration. Reuben did not arrive, though, and Arlene did not drink champagne. She brought out more dip and waited for a moment alone with Trevor, so she could tell him how damn proud she was. But the company stayed, and the program got shown 3 more times, with Trevor fast-forwarding through the commercials. Between the excitement and the half-glass of champagne, Trevor was asleep long before that moment could present itself for real. Arlene woke up sick, which wouldn't have been so bad if Mama had not been in the house. Mama had been sleeping on the hide-a-bed sofa in the living room, yet the sound of Arlene running to the bathroom first thing seemed to bring her out of hiding. That radar of hers. When Arlene came back through the bedroom with the blood all drained out of her face, there was Mama sitting on the side of Arlene's bed. A vision in polyester. But Arlene got back into bed anyway. That's how bad she felt.
Been drinking?
Mama, I ain't had a drink in over a year, you know that.
Big celebration last night. All that excitement.
You were right there. You saw me drinking apple juice.
Don't know what you did after we went to bed.
My God, Mama, can't you never cut me no slack?
Okay, okay. Just asking.
A long, ringing silence. Arlene wondered if she should ask Mama to call her in sick to work. No, she wasn't a kid anymore. She should do it herself.
Stomach flu?
How the hell should I know, Mama? I just woke up sick.
Been happening a lot?
This is the first I've seen of it.
Just thought you might be pregnant.
Oh, don't even think it.
Just asking.
Oh, do me a favor, Mama. Go make breakfast for Trevor. I gotta call in sick to work. I gotta get some rest here.
When she left the room, Arlene felt breath drain out of her in relief. If Mama didn't volunteer to drive back to Redlands today, Arlene might have to suggest it. After the call, she drifted back to sleep, but the nausea woke her again. As she climbed back into bed, Trevor came in to kiss her goodbye. His grandma was ready to drive him to school.
You too big a celebrity to ride your bike now?
Oh, Mom, she just wants to.
We'll get you a better bike real soon.
He sat on the edge of the bed, and she parted his hair with her fingers and brushed it aside.
One night that's okay.
No, you deserve better. Just blow me a kiss, okay? I don't want you getting sick.
Love you, Mom.
I'm real proud of you, Trevor. Just so proud I could split. Know that thing about how everybody gets 15 minutes of fame? That's just about how much time they gave you on that show, huh?
School today's gonna be real fun. I bet Marianne Tellman won't even talk to me.
His face twisted into a satisfied smile.
Mom?
He said on his way out the bedroom door.
I like my bike. Really.
Then he blew her a kiss. She woke up later that morning feeling better, so she called work and said she'd be in for the afternoon. Only just so much work she could afford to miss. But the next morning she felt bad again, only she dragged into work anyhow. Low-grade bug, she figured, though the boss said maybe stress. Arlene couldn't imagine what she had to stress about when everything in life seemed so amazingly good. She spent the morning half-working, half-wondering if she should call Reuben to see if he'd caught the show. How could he have missed it? Or, for that matter, how could he have missed seeing it with them? When she got home from work, Mama was finally gone. But she'd left a note by the phone in that distressingly perfect penmanship of hers.
That reporter fella called. Really needs to talk to you. He wants to fly out and see you in person. Something concerning Trevor and some mail and something I didn't quite get. Only that it was about the White House in some regard. Call him collect if you want, as soon as you can. Maybe you should see a doctor. Could be an ulcer. Maybe you inherit that from your old man. Love, Mama.
Arlene took a deep breath and picked up the phone. Thank God this was Friday, so she could wake up feeling like hell for two more days and it wouldn't matter on payday. She didn't feel right calling Chris collect. It would have made her feel poor, like a beggar. The phone rang five times, then his answering machine picked up. This is Chris Chandler, the machine said. If this is Arlene McKinney, I'm on my way to the airport to grab a red eye to California. I'm sorry to catch you off guard, but we really need to talk in person. All kinds of stuff going on. I promise you I wouldn't give out your address and phone number, but now I've got all these important messages for you. They want me to start the interviews for the Citizen of the Month spot right away. You have no idea how much timing is involved with this. This story may not stay hot for long. See you in the morning. If there's anybody else, please leave a message. Beep!
Arlene glanced at the clock and wondered if she could stomach food.
Wondered how long Trevor's 15 minutes of fame was destined to last. The knock came before 8 a.m. Arlene lay very still and listened to Trevor's footsteps running to answer the door. She swung her legs over the side of the bed, half thinking she would not throw up this time. Her thinking proved too optimistic. By the time she'd managed to dress herself and get out to the living room, Trevor had nearly buried himself in a mountain of envelopes, tearing them open like a kid unwrapping Christmas presents. Chris stood when she entered the room, but she waved him down again.
Oh, you don't look too good, he said.
No, I'm fine. Just stress.
Look, Mom, I got 419 letters, and that's just the first 2 days. And not only that, but Chris says that the network wants to tape an interview with me for Citizen of the Month. You know that thing they do on the 6 o'clock news? Well, next month is me. I'm going to be the Citizen of the Month. Cool, huh? Chris will tell you all about it. Oh, and that's not even the best part. I get to go to the White House. The president invited me to meet him. Me!
Trevor stopped and gasped for breath. Arlene wanted to shake herself more fully awake. Probably some parts of this were happening and other, less likely parts were not.
The White House?
Yeah! Cool, huh?
The White House?
Yeah, the president wants to meet me. And Chris says it's going to be on all the news shows and in all the papers. Me shaking hands with the president!
Arlene looked away from Trevor's breathless expression to Chris.
All by himself?
She asked Chris, who opened his mouth to respond, but never got a word in edgewise.
No, Mom, you get to go, too, on account of you're my mother. And Ruben's invited, too, because he was the teacher who got us to do that assignment in the first place. All expenses paid. We get to stay at the Washington Arms Hotel. Chris says they've got a doorman. And he says somebody from the White House is going to come and get us at the airport in a big car and tour us all around the city. Isn't that just totally cool?
You and me and Ruben?
Yeah, isn't that just totally cool?
Out of the corner of her eye, Arlene saw Chris smile shyly. A trip to Washington with Reuben, who she couldn't even call to ask if he'd seen himself on TV. She felt a slight wave of nausea again and wondered if she should get closer to the bathroom.
That's pretty cool, all right, Trevor.
She tried to sound sincere, because it was cool, unbelievably so, to the point that it hadn't all quite settled in yet. But with Reuben?
Remember when you said we're all supposed to get 15 minutes to be famous? Chris says I'm going to get, like, hours. Boy, I better start answering some of this mail.
Arlene excused herself to the bathroom, silently noting that even the coolest things can cause a sickening amount of stress. From the Diary of Trevor.
Well, this is the last I'll get to write in this diary for a while. Because I'm leaving at home. Shoot, I got a president to meet. I won't have time to write in a silly diary. But boy, when I get back, watch out. Reuben says I have the rest of my life to write down everything that's about to happen to me. I just hope that's enough time.
Chapter 28. Reuben. They took the train to Santa Barbara, then a shuttle bus to LAX, the only part of the trip to come out of their own pockets. On the train, Trevor wanted to sit by the window, and it only seemed right to seat Arlene beside him. Reuben ended up alone, one seat back. He couldn't read on a moving vehicle. It made him queasy. So he sat quietly, watching the backs of their heads. He could hear the endless litany of Trevor's tapping foot. The boy was wired for sound. As Reuben supposed he should be, on his way to the White House. He couldn't help but notice that Arlene, by herself, looked like a relative stranger, or at least somewhat estranged, while Arlene and Trevor together still looked like his family. An odd sensation, one that left his discomfort no room to breathe. In the airport, Trevor talked to him, and talked and talked. Endless strings of breathy speculation. What the president would be like, what sights they would get to see, would they have to go through a metal detector or show ID to get in? He asked Reuben several times, in several different ways, if Reuben thought his Citizen of the Month interviews had gone okay. Then he showcased his knowledge of White House history.
Did you know there was a fire there?
I think I might have heard that.
That's why they painted it white.
Reuben thought Arlene was not listening, but she broke in on that comment.
You're making that up. No, really, the War of 1812, and in 1929. I think they painted it that first time. Is it okay to call him Bill?
Who?
Arlene asked absently.
The president.
Oh, God, no. No, oh, my God. No, Trevor, don't you dare. Don't even think about it. You call him Mr. Clinton or President Clinton or Mr. President or just plain sir.
What if I get to meet Chelsea?
I'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
I hope I get to meet Chelsea. She's a major babe.
On the plane, Trevor opted for the window again, and Arlene sat next to him, which put Reuben on the aisle beside her. It seemed awkward not to talk, but he didn't. Trevor looked out the window, and Reuben fingered the little ring box in his pocket, and wondered again why he'd brought it. And wondered, if she knew he'd brought it, would she then understand that his silence wasn't cold, or wasn't meant to be, but rather a trench he'd dug himself into. A trench that only seemed to deepen with his movements. Maybe at some point in the trip he would tell her, just so she would know that for a moment, while packing, he had missed her and his thoughts had been kind. but that was a big bite for a man who couldn't even seem to discuss the weather or their itinerary. The flight was a smooth one, so he read his book. At the airport, a very young, fresh-faced man in a suit and tie held a sign that read, McKinney Party. The man, whose name was Frank, loaded their luggage in the trunk of a black American-made car and asked if they'd like to stop at the hotel to freshen up. Arlene said that sounded good, but Trevor looked so crestfallen, they asked what he'd like to do first.
See things.
Well, that's my job today, Frank said. To show the three of you around, get you safely back to your hotel, and then I'll be back to get you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock sharp. We'll take a little tour of the White House until it's time for your appointment with the president.
What do we see first?
Trevor said. He and Frank seemed to have formed an instantaneous bond, cutting Reuben and Arlene out of the loop. Which was as it should be, Reuben felt, because this was Trevor's day. What all do you want to see?
The Washington Monument, the Library of Congress, the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, the Smithsonian.
We might not get to all those today, Frank said. But there's tomorrow afternoon. What's first?
The Vietnam Memorial.
Reuben flinched unexpectedly at the mention of the name. What all do you want to see?
The Washington Monument, the Library of Congress, the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, the Smithsonian.
We might not get to all those today, Frank said. But there's tomorrow afternoon. What's first?
The Vietnam Memorial.
Reuben flinched unexpectedly at the mention of the name. Walking down the mall, approaching the Vietnam Memorial, Frank dropped back and addressed Reuben by name.
I understand you're a vet.
I am.
I'm not going to give the usual tour guide spiel. I've noticed that vets don't always like that. You probably know a lot I don't. You might want a moment to view this by yourself.
Reuben swallowed past a tight knot in his throat. Until Frank reminded him, he'd avoided focusing on the depths of his own discomfort.
Trevor said,
We'll wait back here for you a minute, Reuben, and Frank can give me the tour guide spiel. I wasn't there.
Frank's polite laughter echoed in his ears as he walked toward the wall. The sound of his own footsteps seemed to reverberate, bigger than life. 7 weeks in Vietnam, then a week to stabilize at a medical installation, and a quick flight to a stateside hospital. The men with names carved into this black granite had known something about the war. Reuben knew only what he saw in the mirror every morning. Maybe, he thought, that was enough. He studied the index for a time, looking for a specific name. Then he moved along the wall until he found the correct panel, reflecting a time late in the war, and ran his fingers across the names until he found Artie. It jolted him slightly to see it, the reality of it. A recurrent nightmare suddenly become provably real. He reached up and traced the letters with his fingers. A minute or an hour later, he felt Trevor at his right side. In that sudden moment of the child's presence, Reuben knew that his wounded pride was harming Trevor as much as or more than Arlene, and causing Reuben to sacrifice far too much in its name.
Reuben? Did you know how many names there are here?
About 58,000, I think.
It felt strange to talk, and he realized he hadn't for quite a while.
58,183. Who's Arthur B. Levin?
An old buddy of mine.
Arlene's voice startled him from behind.
Trevor, maybe Reuben wants to be by himself.
No, it's okay, Arlene. Really?
Maybe he doesn't want to talk about Arthur Levin.
No. It's okay. He was just someone I got to know in basic training. Artie was a guy voted most likely to screw something up.
He wasn't sure if he was telling this to Trevor, or Arlene, or both.
First time Artie pulled the pin on a grenade, his hands were shaking so much he dropped the grenade. Into high grass. Stood there digging around like he could find it to throw it. I knew he'd never get it in time. He was going to blow himself away. So I ran in and grabbed him. Tried to get him to clear the area. Too late, though.
He died?
The quiet voice of Trevor.
Yes.
Did you get hurt, Reuben?
Can't you tell?
A silence.
I didn't even know him that well. Just better than anyone else there. He was the only person on the continent who wasn't a total stranger.
He felt Arlene's arm circle his waist from behind.
Sometimes I look in the mirror and think, what if I had just run, just saved myself? Artie would be just as dead. I'd still look like the man in the picture, just a little older.
But looking at the wall, he had to wonder, what if it hadn't happened and he hadn't been sent home? Would he be a name carved in granite now? Arlene's breath tickled his ear.
That's not the kind of guy you are. Besides, you'd always wonder if you could have helped.
Whereas this way I know I couldn't. Trevor, go talk to Frank for a minute.
Okay, Reuben.
Reuben turned and held Arlene. Neither said anything for a few minutes. He took a big breath.
I've been doing a lot of thinking, Arlene. I'm the kind of person, when I finally let myself love someone, it just goes so deep. You know what I mean? I know you do. I know because you're the same way. So I was thinking, maybe I can understand that loyalty you felt.
What do you mean?
From the sound of her voice, he figured she knew, but couldn't quite believe he meant it.
What happened with Ricky? Maybe I should feel lucky to have a woman like that. Because years from now, when we have that same kind of history, I know I'd get the same level of loyalty from you.
You saying what I think you're saying?
He placed the little velvet box in her hand.
Well, look what I just happen to have here.
She sucked in a breath, shaky with tears that would show in a minute.
You never took it back for a refund.
Funny, isn't it, how I never did that?
By the time they arrived back at the hotel, Trevor was so fast asleep that Reuben had to haul him in a fireman's carry up to their room. That is, to Trevor and Arlene's room. His own room was just across the hall. He wanted to ask her across the hall with him, but it didn't seem right to leave Trevor alone. They kissed goodnight for a long time, and Reuben said they'd have plenty of time, the rest of their lives, to be together. Arlene smiled and said nothing, seeming nervous or sad, or both. In the morning, Trevor came over and said she was sick and throwing up over there, but when Reuben expressed concern, Trevor said it happened all the time.
It's just stress, he said. She just gets nervous.
Reuben could certainly relate to nervousness. They stood anxiously on the red carpet of the main hall. The cross hall, Trevor called it, staring up at the presidential seal. Reuben thought they faced the front of the building in Pennsylvania Avenue, but Trevor was quick to point out that Reuben was indicating the south portico, facing the Washington Monument. Reuben had given up on getting his bearings. At one end of the hall, the East Room buzzed with press setting up cameras and Secret Service and White House staff. Frank asked Trevor if he was nervous, and Trevor said no, an obvious lie. The president walked in almost unnoticed, surrounded by Secret Service agents and his press secretary. They just seemed like any other group on first glance. Reuben wondered why he had expected some kind of fanfare. A moment later, the man himself spun off from the group and walked directly to Trevor, looking natural and friendly and unintimidating somehow. He shook Trevor's hand.
You must be Trevor. Frank treating you okay?
Oh, yeah,
Trevor said, seeming unfazed.
Sir, I mean, Mr. President Clinton, sir.
Mr. President Clinton smiled and said Trevor should call him Bill. Trevor turned and shot a look at his mother.
The press is still setting up, so this'll take a minute. Everybody wants to get this on the news, Trevor.
Okay by me, Bill, sir.
So, what have you gotten to see?
Everything.
What'd you like the best?
The cherry blossoms. No, wait, the Vietnam Memorial. That was the best because my mom and Reuben got engaged.
Really?
He said, his smiling eyes coming up to take them in. Reuben felt tongue-tied and wished he could handle himself as smoothly and easily as Trevor did.
Wow, congratulations.
Tomorrow's my birthday, Trevor added. Boy, is it ever going to be a good one?
Well, you've just got all kinds of things to celebrate.
No kidding.
A man arrived at Clinton's elbow. Mr. President, we're ready to get underway. Cameras rolled, filling the East Room and filming them with the cross hall as backdrop. The president stood beside them behind a podium and shook Trevor's hand. Reuben tried to look natural, but the lights made him want to squint and blink. And between that and his nerves, the whole scene looked and felt surrealistic.
I'm honored to meet you, Trevor,
the president said.
Yeah, me too, Trevor said. I mean, I'm honored too. I was so happy when you won the election.
Why, thank you, Trevor.
I didn't think you had a prayer.
Reuben's jaw tightened. In his peripheral vision, he saw Arlene's face go suddenly white. The president threw his head back and laughed, a big, friendly, genuine laugh. Little lines around his eyes crinkled with amusement. A light stir passed through the press corps.
Well, Trevor, I guess we're both a good example of what happens when you don't give up on your dreams.
Yes, sir, Bill, sir. I guess so.
Trevor was presented with a small plaque. Reuben couldn't read it from where he stood. He felt himself sweating profusely, but didn't want to wipe his forehead on camera. Sweat ran into his eye and stung. He heard about one out of every three of the president's words. Something about one person being able to make a difference, and a reference to a child's ability to lead us. Reuben felt shocked and unprepared when the attention turned to him. He shook Clinton's hand, knowing his palm felt clammy. He nodded humbly when the president said that children were the future and teachers like him shaped that future. He remembered using the word sir a lot and didn't remember much else. Trevor beamed up at Reuben like this was a birthday party, all fun and no tension. And though it was hardly the moment for the thought, Reuben realized he hadn't known that tomorrow was Trevor's birthday. Why hadn't he known? He would have to buy the boy something. By the time Reuben had relaxed enough to be fully present, the visit was over, and Frank was driving them back to their hotel.
That was so incredibly cool,
Trevor said. Reuben felt sorry to have missed it. He consoled himself to know that it would be on the news and his mother would tape it. Maybe he could slow it down and get a better view.
This has been the best, most incredible day,
Trevor said.
Do you think there'll ever be a day this good again, Reuben? Or do you just get one of these? I mean, my birthday tomorrow, and me and the president, and you and Mom getting married. Do you think I'll ever have another day like this one, Reuben?
Reuben couldn't answer, because in truth, it seemed unlikely. He couldn't bring himself to tell Trevor he might have hit the peak day of his life just before his 14th birthday. Trevor couldn't allow the silence to stand.
You know, this means I only got one more to do.
One more what? Arlene asked.
One more person to help. I got Mrs. Greenberg, and now you two. That only leaves me one more.
You've done plenty, Trevor, hasn't he, Reuben? Reuben was still busy wondering if Trevor would ever match this day.
I think you can be proud of what you've already done, Trevor.
Maybe. But I'll do one more. Somebody else will need something, right?
Reuben and Arlene and Frank all had to agree that it seemed like a reasonably safe bet. Someone always needs something.
Chapter 29. Gordy. To Gordy, Sandy was a bear of a man. A sweet bear. From a wolf to a bear, he thought, in one easy lesson. Nothing angry or dangerous. Not that kind of a bear. Just big and husky. A somewhat shaggy, unrefined appearance that overpowered his conservative dress. He'd met Sandy on the Capitol Mall. Sandy was almost 42, which gave him a quarter of a century on Gordy, but that didn't matter much, if at all. Sandy said Gordy was beautiful. Gordy looked in the mirror sometimes, in the evening before bed, with the door to his room locked, standing naked in front of the full-length reflection.
He appeared wispy and thin to himself, something the wind could carry away. But in another respect, Sandy was right.